Hello, Russell here. I'm excited to share with you for free a bit of my conversation with Judd Apatow. This is to get you interested. Judd Apatow, you know who Judd Apatow is. Now, we'll give you this 10-minute extract for nothing in the hope that you'll go to luminarypodcast.com and get a free trial with them. This is a wonderful bit of the conversation. Judd is, as always, funny and insightful and educational. Anyone who's interested in creativity and accessing the divinity within himself to create a bloody worthwhile life where you feel like you're realising who you truly are should listen to this and get over there, because Luminary's got a lot of good content. A lot of good content. Not just me, although yes, me. Also, Lena Dunham. Brilliant. Trevor Noah. Brilliant. Karama. Brilliant. Right? It's brilliant. Get over there. $2.99 a month. Free trial, 1 week, luminarypodcast.com. Oh, there are some terms and there are local currencies. Let's listen to some comments now for what, from the James McCleary episode? It's ages ago.
No, it's not.
All right. Here's some comments for an episode we've done in the past. This is from Diane Devone. Thank you for this conversation with Dr. James McCleary, the creator of loads of great work. I've been facilitating these types of groups for 25 years. I saw the documentary The Work, and I love that you're bringing this work to the attention of your viewers. It's important and valuable, especially during this time in our world experience. Thanks, Diane. It is. He's an amazing man, and I want to learn more from him. I'm going to learn more from him. Patrick McDonald says, you just convinced me to subscribe to Luminary to hear this podcast. That is the kind of comment we need. That is the kind of comment that's good for old Russ. Mary Olgan. That's a pretty powerful documentary. It's a bit like shamanism, recalling the shards of your spirit that have been fragmented. Yes, we have to find a hole. We have to find these deep organs within ourselves. Now, let's get into this podcast with the great Judd Apatow. I'm not going to promote myself anymore. You know who I am. You know what I stand for. Let's listen to this great man of comedy, Judd Apatow.
Trying to achieve equality with the annihilation of category is not a successful route.
Yes, that's exactly right.
We're in this era where it turns out we were never the boss.
It doesn't look like an ideology.
What's beneath the surface of people we admire, of the ideas that define our time, the history we are told?
Welcome to Russell Brand.
Under the Skin.
There's a kind of mysticism, I think, in comedy, even sometimes in the language around it, make people laugh, like it's an involuntary thing. Sense of humour, like it's explicitly a sense that you're feeling for, that you're looking for. You yourself have talked about intuition a lot, and now talking about how it's a kind of a legacy of your childhood and the sort of strategies you evolved to deal with your mother. God rest her soul, do you feel like that you're dealing in something quite magical and mysterious in comedy, a sort of a tool of revelation?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, my parents weren't religious at all. They never talked about it. They didn't even talk about the absence of it. they never said, by the way, we know we're godless people and we're not filling this hole for you with anything. They didn't talk about atheism. They didn't talk about Judaism. I once said, can I get bar mitzvahed? And they said, no, you just want the money. Because all the kids were making so much money at their bar mitzvahs.
Was that true?
You know what? It wasn't true.
No,
I felt like I feel like all my friends were, you know, going to Hebrew school every weekend, and I felt left out in some way. And maybe I wanted a little money, but I felt like, why am I home on Sunday alone every Sunday while they're all in Hebrew school? But but so that was empty for me. I've only really been able to fill it through, you know, interest in Buddhism and, you know, I'm a pop, you know, pop psychology fan. I read everything, and a lot of it is very helpful to me. I'll have my Eckhart Tolle by the bed all the time, and it really has been very, very helpful. But the only time I feel God or just something, you know, intelligence of the universe, oddly, is in the moment of creative inspiration. I usually don't feel like my supercomputer brain just thought of that. I do get a sense of it coming from somewhere else at certain moments when something incredible happens.
Can you think of a specific example of something that you feel like, oh my God, I don't even know how I wrote that. Like, where did that come from?
Sometimes something just comes very quickly. I was looking at my notes for This Is 40, and I think I thought of the whole thing in like 2 days, just writing it into my phone on like a notes app. It's just like coming very quickly. I'm always fascinated by Bob Dylan, who wrote so many songs in 3 or 4 years. It almost feels impossible that the human brain could do it at that rate. But sometimes when I'm watching people, they just hit on something and it feels magical. It doesn't just feel like he thought of a good line. It feels like something opened up, something spoke to them. There's a moment in King of Staten Island where Pete says to his mom, "I'm sorry I've been so hard to handle." And she's been worried about him his whole life, that he's okay, that he's not going to hurt himself. And then Pete, you know, without pause, added, and it's not in the script, he goes, "I think it's always going to be hard." And it was the most truthful moment in the entire movie. And in fact, the movie kind of doesn't work if he doesn't say that. But I didn't write it. He didn't write it. It just landed in one take. He only said it once. And it's the entire reason why we made the movie.
Beautiful. Like, I feel like that thing that Gary Shandlin said, I'm sure you're aware of, I don't remember where I saw him say it, but like he said, like, all of this endeavor is to capture, like, once in a while some moment of truth will happen and you think, oh, that wasn't an imitation, that wasn't a construction or a concept, that was it. You see it in these, and that sounds like it was one of those where not only is there this sort of almost divine aspect of creation, but it is somehow also delivered. And I think sometimes, Judd, that the reason that it feels so resonant and why George Shapiro says it's like falling in love, and why you speak about comedy with the reverence that you do, is that it is a kind of transcendent form. I think sometimes of comedy that the reason I think it's such a high art form is that, like you said before about the Larry Sanders being a sort of a metaphor for our onstage, offstage, mask, no mask personas, that on some level all of us are aware that we're going through life sort of pretending to be something that we're not, working a hustle, trying to keep hold of something, trying to get something, not letting go, and so all of these sort of games we're playing. And then in those perfect moments of comedy, it's like something looks from behind the veil and tells you, I know this and it's sort of something very cosmic and powerful. And I think about the sort of the archetype of the trickster that is a recurrent perennial religious or spiritual idea, that the trickster is like, in say American mythology, like the hare or the raven or whatever, this character that's beyond, like these sort of oddly morally ambivalent characters that are neither good nor bad, that are not attached particularly to morality, don't have the piety of a figure like Christ or the serenity of a figure like Buddha, but are like sort of telling you, this is a game, this is not real, this is not. And there's, I find that that is one of the, maybe the essential thing about comedy that I find sort of beautiful, the continual revelation of these masks, whether they are the mask of persona or the constructs of our societies that operate on these imagined power hierarchies or imagined, you know, structures.
Well, I remember we were out, we were location scouting for an important scene near the end of the movie. And in the movie, Pete's father was a fireman who died in a hotel fire. We decided not to make it 9/11 because it's so big a subject and means so much to so many people. I didn't feel like a movie could handle it. And I didn't want it to be that everyone was in grief about Pete's father dying. I wanted it to be his problem.
Yeah.
But we're scouting for this important scene. And I was like, well, maybe he like comes over here and he stands here and he looks around. And I look around and I realize that if I shot it like this, it's exactly where the Twin Towers were. And you could see the Freedom Tower peeking out from behind another building. And that is how we wound up shooting this moment. But those moments make you believe in something else.
Yes.
And I like that. I also believe that in terms of casting. And sometimes I bumped into Holly Hunter. I was visiting a college with my daughter, and Holly Hunter was a guest speaker. And I watched her give notes to all these acting students. And then when we were thinking about who should be in The Big Sick, I thought, you know, I just bumped into Holly Hunter, and I feel like that's why. I feel like it's because she's supposed to do this. And then she's brilliant. in the movie. And that does happen. One of the funny ones was when we were doing the pilot for Freaks and Geeks, I had met Jake Kazin, who was, I think, 21 years old. He had directed one movie when he was very young, and I had never seen it. And I asked him to direct the pilot of Freaks and Geeks, and I had never seen his movie. And then after he said yes, I watched it that night, and it was, you know, a detective movie, and I thought, this is nothing like Freaks and Geeks. I mean, maybe I should have watched this before. And then obviously he designed the whole show and gave the notes that helped me and Paul Feig and was a brilliant partner on the entire series. But somewhere in me, I thought, I think he's the guy that's going to join our group.
Wow. Yeah, I like these indications of an ulterior intelligence making itself occasionally felt materially, sort of in some moments. It's one of the ways you can read reality. It's one of the ways you can connect to reality, like acknowledging, at least, some would say honouring, a moment like seeing that tower when this subtextual component is like making its presence felt. That's pretty beautiful. And I wonder even what it is when you sort of, when we talk about trusting instinct or things coming from elsewhere, this is not just logical, rational materialism, is it? It does feel like the very act of creativity, as you have said, is a kind of divine act. It's, and that's perhaps the reason that your instincts are so honed and your intuition has been so successful for you, is that you have a pretty open relationship with whatever that is.
Yeah, I try to, and maybe that's just the absence of other spirituality. At some point, I read somewhere, someone said, about life and death, you have to love the mystery. And I thought, well, that's all I got. I'm going to hang on to that because I don't have any answers. So I better love the mystery because I'm not going to figure this out at all.
I think that's what that ambiguity of the trickster is living in that uncertainty, that unknowableness. And I think it's pretty understandable with your parents refusing to either acknowledge or not acknowledge God. Just that's a space. It's not even a space. It's not a disgusting. If you enjoyed that conversation, join me at Luminary for the latest episodes of Under the Skin. Go to luminarypodcast.com to start your free trial. See you there. Love you. Bye.